Well, kia ora, everybody. For those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust, and in conjunction with the City Library Heritage Team, we welcome you to today's midday monthly military history presentation. It's my great pleasure to welcome today an old colleague, well, a young old colleague, Mike Peterson, who's spent more than 50 years in uniform and has spent over 4 years in the Sinai area as part of the Multinational Force Observers. And this year being the 40th anniversary of the establishment of MFO Sinai, we thought it was a good idea to have a presentation. So I'm not going to rattle on any further. Without further ado, can I please introduce and welcome Mike Peterson.
All right, I am cognizant of the fact, that means I am aware, that a lot of you have got to get out of here at 1 o'clock either for lunch or got to go back to work, or I'm Emmerdale, at 1 o'clock, I'm TV1, so I intend to squeeze 40 years of the multinational force into about 35 minutes. To do that, there's two things to help me keep it mobile, moving. One is you've all got a handout at the stage, I guess, and I'm going to refer to those slides throughout the presentation, and that saves me putting the same slide back up and down, up and down, up and down. And the second one is that at the question time, at the end, I'm going to hang about for a while if anybody's got any lengthy questions that they need to ask. And if they're all too hard, then Mike Oliver's quite happy to answer the hard ones. Right, what we're going to do now is, before I start, is let's see if we can orientate ourselves of where we are. So what I've done is I'll put some arrows on the screen, and they're points of importance, I think, if you know the area. And I'm going to tell you what the arrows are, what they mean, as opposed to putting the words up there. So if we start right at the top right-hand corner, we have Syria. Just down from that, we have Jordan, down here we have Saudi Arabia, the Gulf of Aqaba, down here is Tehran Island, down here is the Red Sea, here is the Gulf of Suez, up the top there in the centre is the Suez Canal, the arrow pointing out to the blue is the Mediterranean, this arrow here is Cairo, take note how far Cairo is from the Mediterranean, it's a long, long way, it does not sit on the Mediterranean, and we missed any, I think that's about it. And down here, Saudi Arabia, as mentioned. Yes, well, where Cairo is, the Nile that goes up to Cairo then goes out into the Delta, which is a lot of tributaries, and people live in between those tributaries. And as a consequence, it's a very dense place when it comes to the people. All right. What we're going to talk about, in fact, is observe, report, and verify. That is a subject of one of maybe 30 subjects I could talk about, 45 minutes each. But I think this one here is just going to explain to everybody what peacekeepers actually do in the Sinai. A lot of people, public people especially, that I ask, they actually don't know. They're peacekeeper. What is peacekeeping? And that's the subject we're going to cover today. New Zealand has been part of the Multinational Force and Observer since 1982. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, from now on, and refer to the Multinational Force and Observers as the MFO. That saves a lot of energy. Over this time, the world has gone through many changes that has affected the way peacekeeping has represented itself in the air, on the ground or land, and at sea. And with the heightening of terrorism, radicalism, extremism, peacekeeping has had to change its strategies to continue to uphold the treaties that it was there to provide or protect, or what it has signed up to do, obviously. Since 1982, the MFO has had to face these challenges simply because of its location. From the initial withdrawal of Israel from the Sinai, through the multitudes of unrest and the Gaza Strip, which of course is part of the MFO border, through the Palestinians tunnelling war material under the borders of the Sinai, to the ISIS making their temporary headquarters within the MFO area of operations, to the Egyptian political internal struggles which still happens today, MFO has had a colourful 40 years. But there is one thing that has not changed from the first day the treaty was signed, and that is the mission and the way it is achieved. Now, the MFO for the Kiwi started in 1982. That was the year the MFO was stood up, and still continues to this day, making 40 years of peacekeeping with a contingent of around 30 people. The makeup of the Kiwis is contributable to the MFO on a very large scale because of their job descriptions. If you have a look at the wiring diagram here at the MFO, all those boxes in yellow are in fact where the Kiwis work. So generally speaking, they control the mobility of the MFO by transport, which is driver training, teaching all those in the MFO how to drive on their side of the road. And in some cases, teaching people how to use a manual gearbox. Heavy haulage transportation and clerical transportation support. Passport control is run by the Kiwis, so there are some 22 different country-type passports that the Kiwis actually control and run. Operation support is run by the Kiwis, although it is headed by a Norwegian in that their wiring diagram. Everyone below the Norwegian is a Kiwi. Combat and field engineering support, yes. Operation support, liaison support, we have a liaison officer there. And also we include our own administration group support. That is, the Kiwis integrally have their own clerk, their own storeman, their own welfare officer, their own Mr. Widget guy, the go-to guy, the thingamy guy. We can control ourselves as our own country if need be, because we have our own support. So in addition to the Kiwis, here are the following countries and financial support parties. Now you have this slide on your knee if you want to have a look at it. Very quickly, on the left-hand side is the countries that are actually situated on the ground in the Sinai. On the right-hand side are the countries that put a lot of money into the multinational force in Syria. You might notice the Norwegians put a lot of money into the MFO. We also put people on the ground, so we get a double whammy from them. And down the bottom is the base supporting team. I'll equate that to looking at the audience. You may remember the Ministry of Works. That is that base supporting team. They keep the power reticulation, water reticulation, the building standing, etc., etc. And they are full of expats, and they have got English people there, Scots, Irish, Welsh, Egyptian veterans, and a couple of Mexicans. And of all that whole group of people from all over the world, these are the only guys, when they were speaking English, I could not understand a word they said. So what do they put together? The mission. This is written quite well, actually. There's a couple of facts that stand out. The MFO shall have, I'm going to insult your intelligence by reading this, the MFO shall have a visible presence of its area of responsibility. A visible presence means we are very transparent. All our vehicles have got big MFO stickers on them. We wear our national uniforms, but we have patches with MFO written all over them. We all wear a red and orange beret with a big white dove of peace badge with MFO written all over it. So our presence is there. You notice even the helicopters are the orange and white. And their job is to observe, report and verify any activities that could threaten the stability of the Treaty of Peace until the mission is terminated by the receiving states. There are three receiving states: Israel, Egypt, and USA. Now, how this is all carried out and by who and the reasons why can be fully studied and research at Google, www.google.com. mfo.org. It's all there in detail, terrific detail. It even has last year's financial and asset audit, 20 pages, font 3, for you to read if you wish to do so. So there's not a great deal left. So thank you for your attendance today, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you have a good afternoon. What I'm going to do is, over the next now 30 minutes plus, is show you a very small portion of the large topic of the MFO that's shown in these contents. I'm going to start off by talking about me. That will last 2.5 minutes. Area of operations and their rubrics, the zone challenges we have, the Force Commander's Warning, Tactical Operations Centre Brief, the incidents and the reporting processes, which is what we're talking about, the observe, report, and verify. Any questions, and then there'll be a written test for everybody to. Now, I've targeted the audience, which is in front of me now, that you are all military-minded. You know the history between the Israeli and the Egyptian treaty. And then you all know your military abbreviations and abridges. And for the sound man, everybody was nodding in the affirmative. All right, what I'm going to do is talk about me very quickly, just so that this answers a lot of questions that people are always asking me, and I was advised that I bring this into this 30-minute presentation. It's actually not me so much, it's the appointment. But in 1993, saw a strategic change in the way Egypt found themselves responsible for security in the Sinai with the threat of terrorism. The two large base camps and 31 MFO remote sites, the vulnerability could change the mission. What was needed was a presence of upgrading remote site defence, IED awareness, IED, improvised explosive device awareness, mine warfare awareness, because there's still thousands of mines there left over from the Second World War, and consequence management. Consequence management is what do we do after either fizz, pop, or bang. Without adding to the MFO establishment, causing alarm and despondency amongst the 11 countries, because MFO has a ceiling of how many people they can have there, and I'm glad to go above that, it was mooted that all these subjects being engineer subjects, that engineers should stand up and embed a new structure of training and bringing people up to speed on defence in the MFO. New Zealand put up their hand and said, we'll do it. Now, there was a bit of a problem there, I guess, because once they said that, they then realised that the only two engineers that are in the Sinai is an engineer major from New Zealand and an engineer warrant officer from New Zealand as well. They've got a 24-hour job, 6 months work to create the mission and accomplish the mission they're doing as it is. To add all this onto it as a separate mission, they need an engineer who's a major, they need an engineer who's got qualifications and has got experience as a combat engineer and as a lance corporal, corporal sergeant, staff sergeant, warrant officer. They also extended the appointment for 12 months unaccompanied instead of 6. Where are they going to get a person like that? So I ended up in the Sinai. And I'll just very quickly give you now what happened to me over that period. I was supposed to be there for 12 months. And at the end of the 12 months, although I did all the planning and setting the benchmarks for this training for defence, it was the Americans doing the training. I was just actually putting together the plans. But at the end of 12 months, I decided that I should be replaced with somebody who could carry it on because we hadn't quite completed it. So I got hold of Wellington and said, have you got a name for me so that I can get hold of this person and give them some forward information so they don't arrive cold when they get there? What Wellington said was Bougainville and Bosnia and the Solomons are causing a bit of a problem, and we've sent all our people out to look after them, and we've got no one to replace you. We need you to stay for another 6 months. So I did 18 months and then came home. A few years later, they got hold of me and said, we need you to go back to revalidate the plans because two of the countries had changed out. I think it was the Dutch left, the Hungarians came in, etc., etc. So I went back over there for another 12 months unaccompanied. At the end of that 12 months, I then got hold of Wellington and said, I need to come home now. Who's my replacement? They said, yes, we have a lieutenant from the Royal New Zealand Air Force. He's got a diploma in civil engineering. And we'll be sending him to two engineer support squadron for 3 weeks and train him all he needs to know in combat engineering. And he'll arrive with a sign and replace you. Okay, so that sounded okay. So the day before the plane left New Zealand to fly to the Sinai, he had a heart attack, and Wellington told me they can't replace him, so I got to stay there for another 6 months. So I did 18 months and then came home. I was home for 12 months, and they wanted me to go back and meet with some higher authority people from the MFO, and spend the 12 months there so that the Americans could be fully trained up into doing their teaching, if you like, instruction on defence, terrorist defence and so on. So I went back for 12 months. At the end of that 12 months, I went running and said, I'd like to come home after these 12 months. And they said, yep, not a problem. We've got a lieutenant, territorial force, lieutenant engineer, Papakura. He's got a degree in civil engineering. And he'll be out there to replace you. And I said, thank you very much. The day I flew out, I had not met him because he didn't arrive until 3 weeks after I left. So we're all together. I did 4 years as Joe Manchin in the Sinai, although I should say in the Middle East because I spent a lot of time in Israel, a lot of time in Sinai, a lot of time in Egypt. There's one small, it's an irking really to me in some ways, but a question that I always have to answer every Anzac Day. I'm going to just bring it up here now very quickly, and that is, when you do a 6 month mission in the Sinai, you're given the Multinational Force and Observer's Medal, and you wear that for life. If you're there for a year, that's two missions. So you then get a second medal. But that's not viable, that doesn't work. So what they do is, when you go out on parade for your second medal, they give you a numeral number 2, and you put that on your first medal. So you now have an MFO medal with a number 2 on it, which says you've done 2 missions. I've got a number 8 on my medal. And every Anzac Day I have to, what I've just told you now, explain to a lot of people why. And did I do 8 missions to the Sinai? And the answer is no, not really.
You got to tell them you're the 8th Army.
Okay, the zones. That's the Sinai, and you'll see lines all over it, and if you can't read that, you should have a copy of it in front of you. The workings of the MFO originally was to observe the withdrawal of the Israelis from the Sinai back into Israel. And that worked very, very well on both sides. One was the observing worked well, and the fact that the Israelis pulled back went exceptionally well also. Once completed, the peninsula was broken into 5 zones. And in treaty accordance, only a set number of military presence is allowed in these zones, or you'll be breaking the treaty. So let me just explain here. This is Egypt proper, North Africa. That's the Sinai. This is Zone A, or Zone 1, 2, 3, 4. And then there's they painted a line out in the sea, and I'll explain more about it shortly. So in Zone A, you're only allowed 1 Egyptian infantry division, 22,000 troops, 230 tanks, and 126 artillery tubes. Zone B, that's all you're allowed in there. Zone C, which is important to us, you're only allowed the MFO and Egyptian civil police. Because the MFO actually is defended by the police. It's only our only defence we have in the MFO. Note, no military presence whatsoever other than the MFO. Zone D, oh, by the way, these are 200 to 300 kilometres wide. The zone inside Israel is 3. Zone D, you're allowed 4 Israeli infantry battalions, 4,000 troops. Note, No tanks, no guns, no tubes, no rockets. And maritime, down the bottom, the Italians look out to sea and patrol with their patrol boats to make sure that this line they've painted down across the water, no Israeli military boat comes across that line and no Egyptian boat goes across that line. Same up in the Red Sea up by Gaza. It's very hard, obviously, to depict. But also, I have seen an Israeli military reconnaissance ship parked right next to the Egyptian reconnaissance military ship, swapping cups of coffee across the... But so long as they didn't cross that line, they were okay. And that's the Italians' job, is to patrol that whole area. I want you just to bear in mind also that in this area around here, there's thousands of ships a day, from cargo ships to luxury liners to Charlie Brown with his yachts, Bob Smith with his paddle boat. And what the MFO has to do is try and differentiate what is all those ships to a military one. So now what we have is the zone that the MFO is in and how this works. That's the yellow bit. Should have a copy of that too, I think. In the north is Fiji Bat, Fiji Battalion. In the centre is Colombia, Colbeck, Colombian Battalion. And down the bottom here is the US Battalion. And that's how it is split up. Some of these countries change and some of these countries have more or less, but at the same time, it pretty much remains the same as far as the mission is concerned. Okay. The problems we have, the challenges that we have here in this zone, is let's take the Fiji Battalion. The zone they're looking for, they have the Gaza Strip, which is onto the MFR. The problems Colbat have is down here at the LAT, they have a border crossing. And that border crossing consists of hundreds of commercial vehicles with produce, tourist buses, people just with their cars on holiday, etc., crossing that border. And Colbat's job is to make sure that all those vehicles crossing there are not military. They also are observing across the Gulf of Aqaba to make sure there's no military ships going up and down in there. And at the same time, everybody, Fiji, Colombia and USA, are looking in the air to make sure that there's no military aircraft. The US Battalion, they've got the fact that that is a terrible, terrible landscape. It is straight up and down. We put a remote site on top of the hill and you can't see anything below you but clouds in some cases. But they can look across the Gulf of Aqaba for shipping, and they can look in the sky for aircraft. Also, they have a town down here called Sharm el-Sheikh. It is one of the top tourist towns in the world. The aircraft fly in there every 20 minutes, 24 hours a day. Ships and liners put up in there. It's the third best diving area in the world. The road that comes up from here on this side of the peninsula, there's a highway straight to Cairo. So in amongst all of that, they've got to then also differentiate between what is military and what is the rest. So you can see the challenges they have there with those zones. Here is the remote sites. This is a US guy observing across the Straits of Tehran to the Sinai Peninsula. I have a little story I'll slip in here. I used to go out to the site about every 5 or 6 weeks to check the remote site itself and the troops to see how it was going. And I actually had an empty helicopter. I would take some Americans with me. And we'd spend 2 or 3 hours there, have lunch, and then fly back home again. But the difference between them and myself is that Tehran Island, that we've got the observation post on, actually belongs to Saudi Arabia. And they've loaned it to MFO to put a remote site on. So every time the Americans flew out to it, they got one day's combat pay. Lots of money, because they were actually flying into Saudi Arabia. And I only brought that up because I got nothing. This is one of the remote sites now in the Sinai looking back across to Tyrone Island. So you can see the terrain is not that flat. Not much room in there for a game of golf or anything like that. This is the Italians looking out at a couple of the patrol boats. They're anchored there. One would be Israeli, one would be Egyptian. And that's done from one of the Italian ships. There's one of the remote sites on south, down to the US Battalion. There is the remote site on the right, is the one at the airport, looking out at the Straits of Tyran, and etc., etc., etc. Now, these remote sites were put on the ground in three places, really. One was checkpoints or road crossings, but mainly they were put in for observation reasons, so that you could look 360 degrees around you for observation. Some of them, or three or four of them, are put in place so that they're looking after big control towers, because in those days everything was by radio as opposed to satellite now. And that some of them are still there, of course. And there's one there. That's a remote site. And he can't see NAFOR. But right up there is a huge communications area. Right, one of the other groups in the MFO are called the COU, which is Civilian Observation Unit. They are civilians. You notice that the MFO is in Zone C, is it? Or 3, I call it. We can't actually go into A and B unless we've got good reason to. So who counts how many guns and how many people, soldiers and how many tanks, etc., in those other two zones? The COU do that. Now, they are Americans, have to be American citizens. They're all the State Department, so they're all spies. In fact, it's the R&R, just to send them out here for 12 months, to give them a break. And they either fly around in an airplane or a helicopter, or by drive around, and count heads, count guns, count tanks, to make sure that doesn't go over that quota on that slide you've got, what's going to be in there. This photo was taken, by the way, they are the visibility, they wear an orange jumpsuit, so everybody can see who they are. The Kiwis call them road cones. Now, that would have been a funny joke and then it dies away, but the COU hated being called road cones, so the Kiwis still call them road cones today. This particular girl here, now some of you may remember a Laura Inglis, was an author, and her parents went out west in the USA, and she wrote a diary. And they grabbed that diary, and they wrote books about it, but they also wrote a TV program called Little House on the Prairie. And Laura Inglis was one of the people in that, writing her diary, if you remember how that went. This is Cassandra Inglis, which is the grandmother of Laura. Granddaughter. I was just checking how many people are waxed on. Alright, we're nearly there, but we're getting on to now is this is as important as part of the observe, report, verify. But this is an excerpt, a live one, a real one, that's really ever, that every morning the general, the force commander, holds his morning daily brief and at the tactical operations centre at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he has a group of people there, and this is some of the slides that come up, and this is what you see, which is going to help you out for the next 24 hours, because the slides here is what happened in the past 24 hours, and it goes something like this. The weather. This is important because that top line, of course, dust or sand, I'd like to know if it's a dust or sandstorm if I'm flying a helicopter out into the desert. The temperature down the bottom, North Camp, 31 degrees during the day, 21 at night. South Camp, 36 during the day, 28 at night. You can acclimatise yourself to the day temperatures. It's just a matter of hydrating them all the time, and you get used to that after 3 or 4 weeks. I used to, lunchtimes, pair of runners, shorts, sunglasses, run around the inside of North Camp, about 5K, and it's quite comfortable. But try sleeping at 3 o'clock in the morning when it's 28 degrees somewhere. That is not comfortable. Some things you don't get used to. All right, this is what happened in the last 24 hours on that day at Gaza Strip. Now, when it comes to reporting, we report all military observance. Everything you see that's military, you report. And under normal circumstances, if it's just a military observance, but it's not breaking the treaty, we send back 2 reports back to the MFO TOC, the Tactical Operations Centre, twice a day. It's when we see somebody breaking that treaty is when life changes as we know. But this is what happened on Gaza Strip. There were 13 total sightings, military sightings, but they weren't creating too big a problem. And the IDF on the ground is 23 APCs and 3 tanks, and there's a green dot there as where that was sighted. And there were 5 explosions heard and a rough idea of where they took place, and 2 flares. And that's what happened on the Gaza Strip just for that day. And this is a quiet day. Then from there on down, Fiji Battalion had 13 total sightings. In the zone, which you're not supposed to have aircraft, in the air they had 14 F-16s, 2 C-130s, okay, 14 jets, 2 transport planes, 1 F-4 Phantom jet, and 3 Arabas. Arabas are like Bristol freighters, but they've got 2 tails out the back with wings on them. 5 explosions. Where the diamond is, they did a top, which is a tactical operation patrol. And where the blue dotted line is, they did a mobile operation task. Colbert had 11 sightings. They had 1 Kafir, very nice Israeli jet. And they did 4 tactical operation patrols and 3 motorized operation tasks. This is in the 24 hours for prime. US back, 2 sightings. They had a Super Devorah and 1 Bobcat. That's the IDF. Now that Bobcat is not a tractor, by the way. That is a ship. And they did a foot patrol and a mobile patrol. Then we get the rotary wing status. We've got all those helicopters in the MFO. The top and bottom one is the medical one, ready to go should it have to be. The stars are those that are operational and ready to run if they have to. Note, Force Engineer's got his own helicopter down there. And the crosses are the phases of maintenance. On the right-hand side, you see the missions for that day were none, so they sit there ready, the pilots are ready if they need them. Red activities. This is where either Egypt or Israel want to put military troops into the zone that they're not allowed to. So they ring each other up and say, we'd like to do this, and they agree with it. And then they tell Rome, which is where the MFO headquarters is, Rome come back down to us and say there's some green activities, and so they carry on. So it's what it is, it's what it's the way it's written. In this case, the top one there, that blue circle, mine clearing, they've got 3 T-72 Russian tanks, big flails on the front, getting rid of mines from the Second World War. So that's a military presence, got to get that right. All the way down the land border between Egypt and Israel, we were building a road. It was a military road. Well, it may not have been a military road, but it was built by the military people. And they had engineer surveyors out there, which are Egyptian military surveyors. And because there's military presence in there, they rang Egypt, rang Israel up and said, this is what we're going to do. And Israel said, yep, not a problem, so it's an agreement. And down the bottom, at the time, Hosni Mubarak was the premier of Egypt, and him and his family always spent time down at Sharm el-Sheikh. The problem was, he had his entourage of police looking after him. He also had an entourage of military people looking after him, so they got an agreement with Israel that they'll have military within that zone. And lastly, the announcements. Rafah border was open. That's a bit of a surprise. Always shut that place. Gaza airstrip is unserviceable. That's a good idea because it's got craters in there as big as this room. And the duty liaison officer is Major Tupou, EGM. Alright, this is how this all works. So you know who's on the ground now, you know the situation, you know the challenges we have. What happens when one of the remote sites observes a break what they believe is against the rules of the treaty? I'll give you a couple of examples of incidents as we go. But what happens is, the observation is made. Very quickly, that is fired back to the Data Operations Centre in the MFO and says there's been a breach. The MFO make a quick decision on the ground. The headquarters make a quick decision on the ground. They stand up an investigating team consisting of a major and a warrant officer, and they send them out to the incident site, normally out to the remote site. Now the report starts. When the investigating team get out there, they have to gather as much information as they can, even if it's not really so relevant. They've got to pull it all in, everything. If the corporal said it was a black helicopter and the lance corporal said it was a white helicopter, they take both those and write it all down. They take maps, they take drawings, they take lines in the sand. They interview everybody they can about the incident. But you cannot use photographs. They're not allowed to take photographs in Egypt of military establishments or military people or military equipment or anything like that. Israel's the same. They're not allowed to, by law, to take photographs of any military installation, etc. Now, in Egypt, if you get caught doing that, they put you in jail. Then maybe some years later your court case will come up. They'll find you guilty and then put you in jail. So that's pretty simple. In Israel it's very similar. They interrogate you. I'll leave that there. They then, if they find that you're guilty, etc., then you are deported. Yeah. So it's easy for us just not to use photograph. Sounds a bit wrong, doesn't it? When you've got satellites up above, you can take a photograph of what Brendan said, reckless smoking, but you can't take a photograph of an incident that's taken place. So once that's all gathered together, that investigating team then go back to the MFO, write up their report, and within 24 hours they have to produce a presentation to the general and his team. Now, you can take as long as you like, but the presentation, the people who are listening to it, consists of the force commander, who has been elected by Egypt and Israel and USA from any country which has nominated somebody to be the force commander. The chief of staff, who's an American. The RSM, who's a Canadian. The intelligent commander, who's a Norwegian. The ops commander, who is a Kiwi. And all the contingent commanders and a typist. Now what that board then does, it makes a decision after a time on the validity of the incident that took place, if it's a flight. And if it does, it then puts their copy of their notes on top of that sort of report and send it to MFO Rome. Rome get hold of this, and then they send their the same copy with their information on top of it to the country which has validated who has broken the peace, if you like, using simple words. Then that country that receives that has to reply within 48 hours, why? But a copy of that also goes to the opposition and tells them what happened. A copy goes to MFO headquarters Rome, a headquarters in Tel Aviv, and also to MFO headquarters in Cairo, and MFO headquarters in Messina. So everybody's in the know here because we are transparent. Nothing is secret. So those that country that wrote that violation, they then send their excuses back, Rome received that, and then send out everything in a package back down to everybody in front. They send it back to MFO Sinai. MFO Sinai send it out to Tel Aviv and Cairo. The investigating team get a copy of that, of the results. an investigating team then go out to the remote site and tell the people on the ground what the results were. So there's no cover-ups. The transparency is there. Everybody's in the know. And that's pretty much what happens. Now, I've got to say, though, that in the end, I do not know of any treaty violation that was done on purpose. A lot of them are accidents. Some of them are mistakes. Some of them are straight out stupid. We've had aircraft where the wingman gets pushed out across the border and he flies over the top of a remote site. Bang, got you. We have the agreed, some of those agreed tasks don't get filtered back to the MFO, so you'll find military presence in the zone, and we haven't been told about it. We had a Fijian remote site in the dark, but saw a military helicopter, or eight military helicopters fly over the top of the remote site. It worked out in the end that it was one helicopter flew eight times over the top of the remote site. But it was the Egyptians doing gun running, trying to catch up with drugs and guns in the UFO. Last minute decision to be made to do that. They tell Israel we're going to do it. Israel said, not a problem. Nobody tells us. We had Israel one time fired a rocket in their zone, or at least in their country. And when it got up in the air, it turned left and landed in the Sinai. And the Colombians saw this rocket go through the air and thump it on the ground. So radio it back. A bit of a mass panic on here. So while the MFO are running around, standing up the investigating team, etc., etc., getting out to the site to have a look at this rocket stuck in the ground, then very quickly inform MFO Rome what has happened before and say, this is what's coming, there's a report coming. MFO Rome said, oh yeah, sorry, we know about that. Israel fired the rocket and it went left, landed in the side. Israel rang Egypt and said, we just accidentally fired a rocket into your spot, into your place. Egypt said, yeah, that's bad, eh? Don't do it again. Bang, clinch, whatever. Didn't tell anybody that there's been an agreement between the two. So it's all dumb and stupid stuff. However, it happens twice a week, roughly, is the number of incidents that take place. So you can appreciate that when people say, what do you do in the Sinai peacekeeping? It's not like those guys dressed in red and black at the Cape Town down in Wellington and down at cricket on trying to keep peace by looking around at somebody who's going to violate by running out into the paddock. There's a lot to do, a lot of training, observation, and you've got to have your smarts about you because the decisions that you're making is affecting a lot of people. Now, I'll also go back now and say that the number of countries that have put people on the ground in the name of peace of the MFO, the amount of countries that have put lots and lots of money into the MFO to make it work. The last thing Egypt and Israel want to do is stuff that. Therefore, it is very, very strict and the observance is very, very tight to make sure that, if you like, everything that happens is just human nature as opposed to somebody trying to break the treaty on purpose and make a mess of it. And I'm not too sure if I'm right in saying this, but it's probably one of the very few peacekeeping, I guess, acts that have taken place in the world that has actually worked. All right, force commanders of the Mighty National Force and Observers. New Zealand have had three. '89 to '91, we had Lieutenant General Don McGuire. Some of you here may remember. I never served with him in uniform, but when he came back and got out of the military, he became the director of the SIS, and so I had a lot of work to do with him when I was in the Five Eyes team. Force commander was also Lieutenant General Warren Whiting. He actually was my contingent commander over there for 6 months. Then he came back to New Zealand, spent a lot of time in our army, and then went back over there as the force commander. And he wears wings because he's ex-Army Air Corps, flying little suits around the place. And right at the moment, we have Evan Williams, Major General Evan Williams. You may, people in here would remember him. He used to be Chief of Staff, 1 Brigade out here at Linton. Then he became Commander of Army Training Group Wairu for about 4 years. I think it was sort of a mistake he made to stay that long, but he was there for 4 years. And then from there went to the MFO as the Force Commander. If there is one sentence which is so truly written when it comes to peacekeeping, it is that one down there at the bottom. If there's one thing that all those countries on that right-hand side and those countries on the left-hand side who put effort, energy and money into peacekeeping, they get their money back through peace. Any questions? Thank you very much.
They're not going to get away that quickly. I'm sure there must be some questions. Where do you see it going in the future? Is it just going to continually roll over year on year? Or
the answer, my opinion, has to be because the answer is yes. For a couple of reasons. One is the way Egypt and Israel work together so tightly now, to have MFO there as well with those other 11 countries, and under that heading or that umbrella of terrorism, where you've got extremism and radicalism and all those, then they're not just doing peacekeeping, but they're doing other stuff as well. Bearing in mind that, of course, Gaza, which is still rampant at the moment, is all part of the MFO border. Plus, of course, that border between Egypt, between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean is being looked after by the Egyptian police as well as the MFR. If we pull out, either Egypt and or Israel would have to put a battalion of men up there to protect their border. They don't have to do that because we're doing it for them. But that's only my opinion. So, yeah. But it has dumbed down with it because there's no animosity between Egypt and Israel. And at the same time, although Israel is back right onto the Sinai, or at least to that zone where there's challenges, Egypt proper is 10 hours away from the area. So they don't really mind a great deal what's going on. They sort of agree with the most stuff. And Israel and Egypt get on pretty good. And look at the location. We're surrounded by all those other countries. Each and every one of them have got something to say out loud. At least once a week. So I think the MFO will be here for a while.
So what did you develop?
Those helicopters have been replaced by UH-60s or Black Hawks. The days we were flying them, they were UH-1Hs, which is the Iroquois. And we were together in the Sinai, and I can remember climbing into one of those helicopters and sitting back waiting for the pilots to come over, leaning back, and I look up and there's a brass plaque up above, and it's got made by Bell Huey Corporation, 1959. So I got out of the helicopter and said to the pilots, I'm not getting in this aircraft, it's almost older than I am. And he went and had a look and said, I've never seen one of those before, I'll take a photo of that. He said, oh yeah, by the way, no, that's how old that little plaque is, the rest of the plane has been reused since then. But we did have another 40 minutes of like a lesson, a talk on just the helicopters, their demise.
Sure, there must be others, yeah.
So, A2 was when RNZAF became involved with the Rotary Wing, joined up with the
yep,
Australians.
That's right.
We had two aircraft that we had leased from the Americans, and the Australians brought over 6 or 8 from Australia, and we worked together as a ANZAC, or Rotary Wing Aviation Unit, based at Algora. Or up to about 86, I think, when Australia's pulled out.
Yeah, the Kiwi guys, when they were flying the helicopters, had it pretty good actually, because they were the taxis also for the dignitaries who were, when you put the MFO together, there's people from USA, there's people, all those countries there, all their their top brass, if you like, came out to visit. And those planes were the taxis for all these visitors. And so they used to fly all over the Middle East. They'd fly to Cairo for a meeting and fly back. They'd fly to Tel Aviv for a meeting and fly back. But then after all that settled down and the MFO looked as though it was all going to work, and Israel and Egypt had shaken hands and said it was all good, then the helicopters then got into what they were there designed to do, which was to do the reconnaissance of the borders and flying people like myself up and down to remote sites. So when they were first there, the Kiwis had it good, and the Kiwis pulled out, the Americans took over.
And the old barbecue.
Yes.
Hi, Mike. I'm just wondering, in terms of the length of time we've been there, what do you think is the learning that we take from that into the Army of the Future for New Zealand?
It's very static, and I think if you stay there too long, you'll find it very routine-ish. There's no such word, but I'll use it. And so we've actually probably run out of any more learning in the side. In fact, we take more across there than what we actually bring home. That's a good question, actually. Especially when it comes to survival, as in defending ourselves. Because as I said originally, it was the MFO were there, no Israelis because they were over the border, and so they're not allowed any military presence inside that zone, so the only people looking after us were Egyptians, the Egyptian police. Now, take nothing away from them, but they were conscripts. 18-year-olds would turn up, left in the desert with a bottle of water and an AK-47 and a lunchbox, and I think every second day a truck drove past and swapped out lunchboxes. Life's a bit different now because of when ISIS put their temporary headquarters in the middle of the UFO, or the middle of the Sinai, that caused an knee-jerk reaction from every company in the world. And the Kiwis were ahead of it. We were there. So, to answer your question, no, we're not learning much out of that.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you talk a little bit about the activities in North Camp?
Yes, I can. The headquarters is there. All the contingents are there. The purpose of North Camp, which is the headquarters, is to look after all those in the remote sites. There were 31 of them. There is now no North Camp. It's been closed. They moved everything to Sharm el-Sheikh, to South Camp, simply because Egypt could not protect North Camp because of the problems they've got in Gaza and the problems of terrorism. So it doesn't happen now. But the 11 countries were there, plus the supporting team at the bottom of the expats, the Irishmen, the Englishmen, the Scotsmen, those people who can't speak English properly. And they all were at the North Camp, and it wasn't actually a forward operational base, that was actually the headquarters of where everything came out of. There's a big airport there, or an airfield there, called El Gora. That used to be an Israeli full military airport. When they pulled out of Sinai, they just left it as it is. And so all the good things are in that spot to build a North Camp. So everything that went on there was as you would in a small town, if you like, because it had everything. Shopping, sports activities like gymnasiums, and I think every country had a bar, as small as it might have been, et cetera, et cetera. And that's now gone.
Given your length of time in the area, you must have learned quite a lot about this, different people involved. Where do you see Arab-Israeli politics and tensions going?
Good luck, Michael.
Arab-Israeli. Actually, no, I don't think you can answer to that. Having been there for so long, every time you hear the word mention of Syria, Lebanon, all those places I've been to, when you're back home again and you put your ears up and you listen, well, that's what's going on, remember that, remember this, etc. That slowly fades away after a while because it's so repetitive, it happens all the time. And now I don't even listen to politics in the area at all. So which way are we going in the future? Nothing much has moved, has it, in the last 100 years, probably.
Well, there have been peace treaties between Israel and some of the Arab states.
Israel and Jordan get on fantastic. We crossed, my wife and I crossed the border into Israel, into Jordan. A very quick story. It was a two-man hut, and there was a guy there, a Jordan military guy with a cigarette and a stamp and a pen and a bit of paper. And outside was a chalkboard, and had visas. USA, 230 US. Australia, 300 US. England, 250 US. No New Zealand. So we go in and said that we rocked up. In fact, we just got to the guy, and he said, "Do you have a light?" I said, "No." So he left the office, and we had to wait there for a while. And come. And I said, "New Zealanders." He said, free. Stamped it. And we go. I went, how do you put all that together? You know. However, we found out that on the way back, we were in a taxi, a Jordan taxi. And the guy from the taxi driver said, "Where are you from?" I said, "New Zealand." "New Zealand." I said, "You don't even know where New Zealand is." "Yes. My whole family eat New Zealand lamb every day." We were sending live lamb ships, remember them? He was eating live lamb every day. We can only afford to eat it once every 7 years. So, on the ground, what you see on the ground as a soldier, having mixed with the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, for so long, having mixed with the Lario or the liaison Egyptian military for so long, is a completely different world to Charlie Brown on the main street that you run into. We'd go to Tel Aviv for a couple of days, come home and then find out which bus got blown up and what street got destroyed. Two completely different worlds. Politics is up here, and over here is the rest of life in the Middle East. We befriended a lot of Palestinians and got on so well with great people. So I can't really stand here and have any argument one way or the other.
Right. Well, unfortunately, I think we've just about done our dash time-wise, so can you just join with me in thanking Mike in the usual way?